Hi everyone, and welcome to The Imperfectionist, where we celebrate the beauty of trying, not perfecting. I'm half of Carla, and each week we dig into the real stories behind people who seem to have it all figured out. But the truth is, guys, none of us really do. I hope you've had a really good week. This week I have been joined by my best friend Kirsty. If you'd like to go back and listen to her episode, I will leave it in the show notes down below. She came over to help me with some business stuff. So we actually got to work together for half a day, and the rest of it we basically just sat there nattering away and working beside each other, because that's what best friends do. For those of you who don't know, my best friend lives in Spain at the moment, and she used to live in Malta. So she's quite an international lady, but we even got to go to an event last Wednesday, which was so lovely. I actually got to take your bestie to work kind of night. We went to the number 7 Future Renew event, and it was all about the importance of sleep. And it's so interesting. There was a couple of things, like, I didn't even understand how impactful sleep can be on you, to help basically, like, how your dreams are ways of clearing out what you want to keep versus what you don't want to keep in your brain. Isn't that kind of crazy? I think that's correct. Don't quote me, but I'm pretty sure that's what I picked up from it. So, but it was really, really interesting. And it was lovely to actually get to go to an event with somebody that, first of all, that I know, because I didn't know many people there. So it was nice to have somebody. So yeah, if you want to listen back to Kirsty's episode where she talks all about being authentic and, you know, how we became friends and adult friendships and finding yourself when you are older and reinventing yourself. And I use the term older loosely, but like in her 40s, basically she reinvented herself. So make sure you check out that episode. But this week, my guest is Irish singer-songwriter Ruth Ann. And we spoke about how she got started, the harshness of the music business back then, and some of the huge names she's worked with. Like, guys, like, this is crazy. Like, some of the people that she has worked with. We talked about her songwriting, her self-belief, and living with the chronic pain from endometriosis. And it was really fascinating to hear from somebody directly, because I don't have endometriosis and I've never known anybody who has it, but the impact that it has on our life. And I know that so many of you guys listening do have it. And it just, yeah, it made me really think about the impact of day-to-day living with that kind of chronic pain. Just to let you know that we recorded this episode remotely, as Ruth Ann is based in London. And there was a slight technical hitch with my voice for a minute about halfway through. Apologies for that, but do bear with it, because you don't want to miss this one. Without further ado, here is Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann, one of the first questions I always ask people when they come onto the podcast is,
yeah,
what's one thing you used to tell yourself that you now know not to be true?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. What did I used to tell myself that I know? Probably like that I wasn't good enough, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I wasn't good enough and I wasn't pretty enough. All the enoughs that we tell ourselves was definitely what I told myself for a long time throughout my career.
What do you think was the enough?
I think it was probably just being around the wrong people. I think there's a lot of people that like to make you feel that you're not enough, but it's nothing to do with you. It's them projecting their own insecurity. So everyone's projecting, and then you think that it's to do with you. You know what I mean? That projection. So I think sometimes when people, you know, can say things and they can stick with you, words are very, very powerful. And I think that we all remember when we were like 11, 12, you know, 14, 15, someone saying something to us that then stuck with us forever. It sticks with you, even though that person, but a lot of the time those people would have been projecting their own insecurities onto you, or their own fears or doubts or anything onto you. And then you pick it up and you go with it. And then the cycle continues. So I think it probably was through people just saying things that, you know, I came from a family that were so encouraging and always made me feel like I was enough. And then it was like I landed in Hollywood when I was 17 and it was like, oh, you're not enough. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need to be skinnier, you need to be prettier, you need to be, you know, yeah. So I think it's other people that make people feel that they're not enough.
And then you take that on, and that becomes the narrative that you live by, then the story for yourself. Was there anything in particular like that you can remember anybody saying to you, or was it just like
Oh,
a
loads.
culmination?
Loads of things. I always got told, you're cute. This is what I was told. You're cute, but you're not pretty enough to be J-Lo. So you're not stunning enough to be like a J-Lo. And you're not ugly enough to be like a quirky or like big. Like, I mean, you're not quirky enough to be like a Beth Ditto, which, by the way, she's beautiful, but this is what was said to me.
Cheers.
So you're not quirky enough to be this, and you're not, you either have to be really beautiful, really quirky. You can't just be in the middle. You can't just be cute. That was one thing that was said to me. You're not
Who said that
marketable.
to you?
That was said to me by an old manager I had. And it was also said to me by in the same type of way, the same type of thing, like you either have to be stunning or quirky. And which is so crazy because if you look at the stars of today, there is no rules. This is when labels were making the decision of who was a star. You'll never make it with a nose like that. All the stuff. Like I got told so many things.
It's I find it so interesting what you said there about that, like now it's so different that now, but when you said there that the labels used to make the decision on who was going to be a star, what's changed now for us like lay people who have no idea of the industry, just like looking at it, what's the difference now?
People are deciding. People online are
Fascinating.
deciding. I mean, like even Simon Cowell said he never would have signed Billie Eilish. He didn't get it. And people are now making those decisions. And Billie Eilish is beautiful, by the way, as well. She's absolutely stunning. But there was a certain look you had to have back then. In when I started, when I was 18, 17, there was a certain look you had to have. And I think that that's changed now. Even with like Ed Sheeran was always told, like, drop the ginger hair, you need to dye your hair, you need to stop looping the pedal. All the things that made him unique were what you were always told to strip away about yourself. And he proved that that was wrong as well. But for women, we have it, we always had it harder. Like, do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But now, anyone can be a star. Like, there's no star look. Do you know what I mean? Like, anyone can be a star. Like, the guy, like, anyone, like, look at like Teddy Swims or Lola Young or like, they're all really unique in their own way. They're just being themselves. And I think that these days, authenticity is what really makes a star now. Accepting who you are and accepting the parts of you that people might try and change, accepting them and going, no, like Lady Gaga was always told she'd never make it because of her nose. Do you know what I mean? It's like, look at her.
Yeah.
So it's embracing who you are and finding your unique parts and then going with that. And I think once I did that when I was older and I wrote a song like The Vow, which is completely the opposite song that I would be hired as a songwriter to write because they would want the big radio, big pop smash. And for me, I was like, I'm just going to do what I would want to do. And this Irish Celtic soul chant ballad. And that's been my most successful song as an artist so far. So it's like that it, when you actually lean more into what you really want to do and who you really are and the authentic self, the impact that that can have is so much bigger. And that was when I started rewiring my brain to go, oh, you are enough. You are enough. And this is, and it's not about being a star. It's about being your authentic self and putting out your art that you're proud of. And that's what goes on to make an impact in the world in ways that you could never have imagined.
Everything that you're saying, it just sings so true to my heart because, like, for me personally, my whole life I was pretending to be somebody I wasn't because I didn't know who I was. And it was as soon as I got to know who I was and started to do everything from a place of authenticity and vulnerability as well, the difference in like my life in 5 years is completely transformed purely from that, like I've had a massive weight loss and things like that, but that's so insignificant in comparison to the change in who I am
Yes, in your
and
mind.
in your mind. And then when you communicate that out and you share that with the world, you find your people. That's when people come to you. So when you wrote The Vow, like what made you decide to change the way that you the way that you communicate your art? Like when you do something that's not like the big pop ballet,
Yeah.
how do, like, what was there a switch? Was there a moment that you were like, no, this is what I want to do?
Well, no, because I woke up in the night and I in the middle of the night and wrote the lyrics of the vow down. And I thought that I they were like the cringiest, cheesiest lyrics, because at the time I was quite brokenhearted. But it was more that I think you get to a place when you're a songwriter like I am in the industry where you're always trying to write the best song possible, A. B, but for the artist that I was writing for, you have to write, you can't write number 12 on the album. You have to write the single. It has to be the single. So you're in a very competitive, high pressured scenarios. But a lot of the time, luckily for me, I was writing with friends. So it never, f it sometimes felt like that. But a lot of the hits that I've been a part of actually were born out of like inspiration and whatever. But it's always at the back of your mind, like this has to be the single, the big song. That's what the label need from me as a songwriter. And I think as an artist, I'd made a decision to just write whatever I wanted to write, and I wasn't going to think about that. And I think that that decision of just like, I'm just going to write my story, and I'm just going to, for a second, forget about radio, forget about numbers, forget about fame, and if anything, well, fame is never my thing anyway, but forget about all of that. A big artist cutting it, anything, and just write what's in my heart. And I think that when I wrote The Vow, there had been a massive buildup of all these songs that were ready to pour out of me, and The Vow was that, like, it was just, I just needed to let it open. And once I woke up in the middle of the night and I wrote those lyrics, and I thought they were terrible, like the lyrics that are in The Vow today, I thought were terrible. I am lucky that the next morning I went into the studio and I just said, okay, just say it to the boys. They're married. They might think they're cute and not cringy. And then when I said it to them and I read them the lyrics, they were like, I was like, I don't know if these are like good or bad. I can't tell if they're cheesy or beautiful. And they said, oh my God, that's like a vow you'd say at a wedding. And I was like, and then I was like, oh, okay, I'll call it The Vow. And then, because I wrote it, the song, thinking, and then it was written like 45 minutes later, but I wrote it thinking about my parents who are this year married 50 years. And I thought about the love that I wanted to find. So I actually think The Vow was a manifestation of a lot of things. It was that unconditional love. And I think that I didn't have that as far as romantic interest, but I had it from friends and I had it from my family and I saw it in my parents. And I think that I manifested my husband. I met him 3 months later after writing that song. And I think I almost like manifested him. And I think now when I get sent videos, it reminds me that, like, how funny that I thought that these were terrible lyrics, and how much these lyrics now mean to people in their lives is mad. But I'm just lucky that I was vulnerable enough and brave enough to, say it to the, say it to the people I was working with, because they could have been like, oh, those are terrible. And then the vow wouldn't exist. But they were like, these are
Imagine if
great.
it didn't exist.
If it didn't.
Imagine like the amount of people that that song has impacted. Like, because I always think of it like James Hetfield wrote Nothing Else Matters and thought it was one of the cheesiest, like didn't want to sing it, like, and he played it for Lars and Lars was like, this is unbelievable. And now
Yeah.
it's, you know, one of the most famous, they were one of their most famous songs. And it's
Yeah.
amazing how maybe it's just that little bit of support, that just that little bit of like a support network to go, no, you're in the right, or you're on the right
Yeah.
track here. Have you had people like that?
Had people not support or support?
Both, actually,
Yeah.
in
Yeah,
like in
there's,
terms of your creative.
of course, there's going to be times where you might say something that you think is deeply profound and amazing, and someone in the room will be like, no, I don't get it. You have to follow your gut. You can fight for it and have a bit of a debate. And my whole thing in a creative setting is, well, let's try it. Let's try it, or let's beat it. Let's try beat it. And then if we, and I've been lots of times where we've had debates about, can we better this lyric? Can we? And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. And sometimes you have to go, okay, well, this is the best that we could do today, and you can come back to it. But I think with The Vow, it happened so fast because there was that support in the room of like, when I walked into them and said I wanted to do an Irish Celtic chant soul, trust me, 7 years ago, like, it was like they could have been like, that's never going to be heard by anyone. But they believed in my vision and they trusted me. Even the weird barrage, The Vow has a weird bar. Guitarists always hate me. It's a weird barrage. it technically breaks the rules, whatever. And there was a debate about that. And there was a debate about the word constant. It was like, has "you are my constant" ever been said in a song? Is constant weird? We had a debate about that. But ultimately, it was like we kind of just went for it. And then when we listened back to it, it was like, nah, like it doesn't matter if nobody hears the song. I think it's beautiful. Like, and I think that when you make art from that pure place, it's like the best day ever. The process of the day of that song was so magical. And then the fact that it's come out and been a part of so many people's like life moments, it kind of like blows my mind because, like I said, I wasn't in a relationship like that other than my like unconditional love. Like I said, I was writing it from a place of what I wanted to find in a partner. And the fact that like me just kind of looking at other relationships around me and digging the lyrics from that, and then that goes on to be what people actually feel and what I feel in my relationship that I found, is mad to me that I almost like wasn't in that scenario, but now I am, if that makes sense.
Yeah, literally manifested it. You literally brought
Literally.
it to fruition.
Yes,
It's
without
amazing.
meaning to, yeah.
And growing up in Ireland, what were you like as a kid? Like what was like young Ruth Ann like in school, and like what did she want? Did she see herself always being in music, or
Yeah.
yeah?
I was the kid that I was writing songs from seven. I was in the church pews at four. I probably was the most annoying, let's be honest, I probably was very annoying as a child because I was put on, at four, there's videos of me singing. I was put on pub tables, chair tables in Baldoyle in the race course. My mum, we used to go there. They used to go there for drinks, and I'd be up 4 years old singing for everyone on a Sunday after mass. I
That's
was in
Baldoyle.
Baldoyle, because
That's
I
where I
live.
live.
Oh, I'm from Donaghmede, so I literally was from
Okay.
Donaghmede. Yeah, so like I'd be in Donaghmede Church in the pews at four, and you couldn't join the choir till you were like five or six. But they made an exception for me because I was singing all the songs at four from the pews.
You were doing it anyway.
Yeah. So I think that's where I learned song structure, and then I started writing songs when I was seven. My dad gave me like a two-track tape recorder with a mic, and I would switch the tapes and I would do harmonies. I would, no one told me to do it. I just was doing it. And I was around a lot of music. My dad like air guitaring to Cream, to fill in it. My mum was singing Garth Brooks. There was Leonard Cohen, Carole King. All the greats were always on in my house. There was a lot of music, sing songs everywhere we went. So I was that kid. And even like what started to happen was we went on holidays when I was like eight. That was our first like on the plane holiday, and I begged my mum and dad like to sing karaoke, and they're like, "But you don't know any songs." I said, "I know the Gre I know Greece. I know I Hope So You Devote to You." So I sang, and that was the first time that I performed kind of in front of an audience with a mic, and I was so confident, even though I sounded like a chipmunk. I won the competition, and I won. I got myself a Coca-Cola, winning the competition and a free t-shirt. And they gave my mom and dad a free drink. I said, "Oh my God, your daughter's amazing." And they videoed it. And then I realized like, and people started giving me like a pound here. I was like, "Oh, I could make money from this." Cause my 8-year-old brain was like, "Oh, okay, we don't have money." But so I used to go around my neighborhood and I go, "I'll sing for you if you give me 50p." When we wanted sweets, I would go up to
I love that.
gangs are probably dangerous to do now. I would go up to gangs of people, guys, I'm like older me, and be like, "I'll sing for you. Sing Mariah Carey." So I was just, people always are like, "Oh, did you think you were good?" I was like, "No, I just, people would react." So I was like eight, and I was like, "Yeah, give me 50p. I'd like to go get some sweets." So I think the Ruthann, and also it was my coping mechanism. So it was how my parents, it made everybody happy when I sang. And it kind of felt like my mum would always say, like, "This is your gift." And I'd be like, "What does that mean?" And she'd be like, "Well, everyone gets a gift and this is yours." And I'm like, "What do I do with it?" And she would say, just share it with the world. Just make people feel something. That's all you have to do." And so I always felt like it was my thing was singing and songwriting, telling stories and singing. So I just kind of, that was me as a kid. There's lots of stories of me being at Burger King and McDonald's on tables at 13, 14, singing Mariah Carey. Like I would just sing for anyone. And then songwriting and singing just kind of came together. So I was obsessed with music. Teachers will remember me not going to supervised study. My parents paid for supervised study. This is so bad. And I would be in the music room playing piano and writing songs, and the teachers would actually come in and be like, can I hear your new song, or can you play me
No
Alicia
way.
Keys? And they would come in and sit because they knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I would write lyrics during classes, and they would take the lyrics, and I'd be like, no, that could be my Grammy winning lyric. Like, I was so obsessed with music. There's no, from when I was, from as far as like back as I can remember. So it was always going to be, it was always, I always say to people, it's always what I did, whether I was being paid for it or not. I became a professional songwriter at 17, but to me, I'd already been doing like the 10,000, I'd been writing 600 songs by the time, it was just, it's always just what I did.
It's just always been in you. And was there any moment like where you had to kind of fight for belief in yourself? Do you think, like, as you were getting older and kind of switching into this as a career?
Yeah, I think I still do that. I think every creative person is always having dealing with like, oh, have I got it? Have I still got it? Like, do I believe in myself? Like, I would say that my parents' belief in me really helped because they weren't pushy, but they were very encouraging. Like, I'm 7 and I'm singing them a song, a terrible song, and like they're going, that's great, write another, like, do you want to write another one? And it's like it was very like encouraging without being pushy. When I would ring them when I was like in my 20s in LA, broke, having had hits, having had years of no hits, hits, goes back and forth. And I would say, Mom, I'm gonna have to get the boat home. Like, that's how broke I am right now. Like, I'm gonna have to get the boat home. And my mom would be like, just believe in yourself. Just keep working hard. Like, do what you need to do. Like, get a job on the side, whatever. They just always believed in me. And I think that that belief from friends and family, like, always has kept me believing in myself. Like, if I listened to all the people along the way who said no, or you're not good enough, or all those comments, I would have given up a long time ago. But I always had a support system that were like, don't listen to that. Luckily I didn't, because I literally would have given up a long time ago if I listened to some of the people in Hollywood.
It's unusual, though, to have that much support from people to actually help you to get through, though. Like, in a way, you're very lucky to have had that, because without that support system and without being true in your resolve of what you want to do, that's shaky ground when the world starts telling you completely other things.
My mom and dad always told me to just keep it about the music, like, go back to the music. The music is the safe place. Like you don't need to talk about it, show people with your music. And so I always thought about that as well.
You headed off to the States at 17. What was that like? It must have been a bit of a whirlwind, total culture shock and
It was such a culture shock because I'd never been to America.
Oh,
I'd
wow.
never.
Okay.
So it was like, yeah. And it was the day after I finished my leaving cert, because that was my mum's, you've got to get your leaving cert, like, to just have in case. And so that was the agreement. And then the next day, I was on a plane to LA after I finished my final exam, and then landed in Hollywood. It was all the things, like, it was, yeah, seeing like the richest of riches and the poorest of poors. Because in LA, it's very much, you're either very rich or you're poor. Like, there's no real middle class. I had a manager at the time who managed the script, Mark and Danny from the script, who weren't the script yet. They were working over there as writer producers. So he had kind of spent time at my family and been like, I'm going to bring her over and work with Mark and Danny. We'll develop her as an artist and we'll get her a record deal. And then, like, I think it was the third day in, he brought me to meet Billy Steinberg, who wrote, obviously, one of the most legendary songwriters of all time. He wrote Like a Virgin, he wrote Two Colors, he wrote Falling In, he wrote just so many things. And there was a grand piano and a Grammy on top of it. And he said, all right, play for me. And I played, like, now that I'm thinking about it, the worst song ever. But I thought it was like, oh, my new song, like, 17, here's my song. And I had the confidence of, because I hadn't been damaged yet by the industry. I hadn't been, I was completely like, okay, yeah, I'll play for you, whatever. And then he was like, I like you. He's like, your voice is like Christina Aguilera. I like your songwriting. Like, come back and write with me and Josh Alexander. And the
Wow.
next, and the, and you know, the next day or two, we wrote Too Little Too Late and another song that day that would go on to be my first hit as a songwriter with JoJo. But it took 2 years for that to happen. So I was kind of developing as an artist then and everything. And then that song came out when I was 19, and then that just changed my life forever. It was like the biggest breakthrough I could have ever dreamed of.
What was the difference then when that song, what does it feel like, first of all, to hear your song being played like on the radio by other people? Like, it must just be the weirdest, insane feeling ever.
Yeah, it's the best feeling. It's the best feeling still, even today. It's like if you're in a car, if you're in an Uber and your song is on, you never get used to that. You're in a cycle class or and your song is on. And the best thing is that people don't know. So they have the most genuine reaction and the most genuine, like they're either turning up the song, they're like, yeah, and you're like, and they're working harder to the song in the class, and you're looking around going, oh my God, they have no idea. Or you're at Coachella and everyone's singing it at the top of their lungs, and you're standing there like, oh my God, everyone's singing the song I wrote, and they have no idea that I wrote it. I love that. So the first time I heard that on the radio was I was in New York in a yellow taxi cab, which is so like a movie moment because I'm Irish and I'm in this like yellow taxi cab in New York. And I was just screaming. I was just like, that's my song. Yeah, it was mad. That was a mad time. And to have a song like my first hit be so global and still like it's almost 26 years, like 26 years since it was released, like it still people know it and sing it. And it's, yeah, that's like something that I'm just so grateful to Billy and Joshua because they took a chance on me. I was a new songwriter and, so I'm just so grateful to them for that opportunity.
And what does the songwriting process look like for you? I'd love to know, obviously with the vow, it was the middle of the night, you wake up. Is that the general kind of way that you write a song, or do you sit down with a notebook, or do you like how do you have a process, or do you just
My process is just being open,
okay.
because anything can happen and songwriting is the unknown. So I always am open to anything that could inspire a song. So we could be talking and you could say something and I'll jot it down or I'll remember it. Or I could be in the shower. I've written songs like breastfeeding my new baby. It's whenever the inspiration hits and it's just getting it down, the idea down. So I write a lot of titles in my phone. I write a lot of phrases, conversations that I have with friends, anything they say that I'm like, oh, that could be a song. I write it in my phone. And then as far as like going into a room of people, I always really stay open to like if I'm in with an artist, I like to really try and get to know what's going on in the artist's life so that we can write something. The song is normally in the conversations that you have in a writing room. Sometimes it's chords are really inspirational. Sometimes people will just play the most beautiful chords and that will inspire me. Sometimes I've written songs fully in my head and I've gone in and been like, this is the song. I just need chords on it kind of thing or music. And we just kind of build it from there. So I really stay open like to the process and never too stuck to one thing. I think you have to stay very open when you're writing and let the ideas like flow in. It's like, yeah.
And is there one song that either that you've written, or like a song credit that you're most proud of?
Is there a song? I mean, honestly, they're all like my babies, and it's like sending your babies off to college when they go out into the world. So, like, I'm so proud of them all. I'm just proud to be here and like yeah, I'm proud of them all. I mean, getting a song, like getting a single with Diana Ross and having songs with John Legend, like artists like that really and like being nominated for Grammys and stuff, like that
That must
is
be.
to me like something that I'm really proud of because I'm like the teenager in me in Donnymead playing Ordinary People on the piano. And then I'm literally voice noting my best friend Jenny going, I'm on the way to write with John Legend, like just me and him. He's on piano
Just
and
the two of you.
just the two of us. Yeah. And like getting to write with him in that capacity of someone that I looked up to and respected and inspired me, is mad. And for him to be like, what way should I sing that, Ruth? Or what? Or like, yeah, I like, and I'm like, oh my God, John Legend. And like, and having Diana Ross even know who I am and hear my voice on the demo and, have her last latest single be my song. It's like that's just madness. That's like madness
That is
to me.
absolute. That is must be the most wonderful feeling, though. The most amazing, like even getting to meet Diana Ross or John Legend, you know, like even to that point, but then actually getting to work with them in a way that means so much to you must be just incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible the people I've gotten to meet and what I've gotten to do. And it's so funny because you're always moving to the next thing as a creative. So I never like sit and think about those things really until I'm being interviewed about them. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's
That's
mad.
kind of cool.
That's
Yeah,
kind of weird.
we never really take a moment to celebrate the things that we've achieved, do we? Like, and really let them sink in. It's always like, what's next? What's next? You know,
Yeah,
let's
I
find
do.
the next thing.
But I do now because I think when I was younger, it was very much like, what's next? What's next? What's next? But as I get older and I have kids and I have a, like, I'm like, no, this is hard to do. These things, especially these days in the music industry, this is hard to do. So we need to celebrate.
Cool.
We need to have the plaques. We need to be, but not wallow in it, but celebrate it, because it's difficult to achieve some of these things. And you know,
You
take the
have.
time to pat yourself on the back and remember that, like, you know, you didn't reinvent the wheel or anything, but just like it's something cool that you get to tell your kids
Damn
when they're
right, it's
older.
cool. It's really cool. You've been really open about your experience with endometriosis, which I think I know to make a massive shift, but like I think it's something that a lot of us don't speak about or we don't even know about. I know that recently there was I think it was on Hollyoaks, there was a scene where one of the young girls was going through, and it was like the first time that people were like, this is actually what it's like, you know. So I just want to say, like, thank you for that, like for raising that, I think, as well. It's just to let people know that this happens to women and what it's like. Like, when did you first get your symptoms and know that there was something different going on?
So my case was different in the way that I was on the pill from when I was 17. So the pill is almost like a band-aid over it. You know, it suppresses, it helps it can help the symptoms of endometriosis. I didn't know that I even had anything. I had painful periods and they were heavy, but I didn't think every, you know, at back then you were told that, you know, periods are painful, whatever, deal with it. But when I went on the pill,
Deal with it.
I deal with it. When
Yeah.
I went on the pill, I barely felt anything, and like period, like time of the month wise. So it was easy for me, you know. And I was on the pill till I was 30. And it
Oh
was when I
God.
was 30 and I came off the pill to take a break because I was single at the time. I was like, I'm going to take a break. I read something about like your egg reserve.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to take a break and get back to my natural cycle for a while. Because I've been on the pill for a long time. And it was then that I started experiencing like horrendous pain. And, you
Wow.
know, it was like, oh my God, what is this? To the point where 6 months later, I went back on the pill because I was like, I can't deal with this. I was missing work. I was leaking in public. It was awful. I was in the bed for 3 days. I was like, this is not normal. So the doctors were like, just go back on the pill then. I went back on the pill and over the next 2 years, I start like gradually. Over the next 3 years, I started gradually getting more and more pains. I didn't know they were related to my time of the month because for 2 years, I had daily chronic pain every day for 24 hours a day. The only time I had a bit of relief was right after my time of the month. The pain would subside a little bit for about 5 to 7 days, and then it would come back every day, 24 hours a day. So I had that for 2 years. So mine kind of went from like 0 to 100, obviously, because it was being suppressed, I think.
Yeah.
And it just was like, I can't. So I didn't know that it was even related to my period. By the time the pain was getting as bad as it was, I went for food allergy tests. My weight gain was crazy. And I was fainting in gyms, collapsing. I was just in so much pain, fatigued. Like the type of fatigue that you could rest and never feel refreshed. And I just kept going back to doctors saying like there's something wrong with me. And they were like, no, your bloods are fine. All my scans were fine. So I had ultrasounds, MRIs, everything, you name it. I had it for 2 years. Everybody said I was fine. And I just was like, no, but I know that I'm not. And my quality of life went from like me being the most social, dancing for hours, at night, out with my friends, became like couldn't leave the house. Putting on makeup was like climbing a mountain. Taking a shower was like I had to get back into bed some days.
Because of the
And
pain and the fatigue.
yeah.
Wow.
And I was touring at the time with like Alanis Morissette. And I would literally go from the bed in a robe to the stage and back to bed. And that was my life. And then I was like, this isn't right. So I, found a doctor, went private in the UK, found a doctor who took the first consultation. He spent 2 hours with me going through everything. I'd taken a pain diary, a food diary. And he was like, I'm 99.9% sure that you have endometriosis. I knew it was that. I was saying it to doctors. It's definitely
Okay.
that because I had done research. And they were like, no, that's really hard to diagnose. Like, let's try find everything else. So anyway, he took care of me. He did a wide excision surgery in 2019. It took 4 hours, and it turned out I had like stage 4 deep infiltrating endometriosis in my bowel, bladder, and pelvis. And he said that if I'd been on a public list, I would have lost my bowel, that it was getting to that level.
I didn't know that it could have that effect to that level. That's
Oh yeah, people are,
wow.
stoma bags. You lose ovaries, you lose, if it infiltrates the organs deeply and they have to remove them. So I was very lucky. I credit him with why I got back certain quality of life and I was able to have my 2 children. Because he took such good, and still does take such good care of me, helped me with my fertility. And I have adenomyosis as well. So I have,
What's that?
it's like the sister disease to endometriosis. It's basically inside your uterus. And
Wow.
so that the
Okay.
only cure for that is for them to take out your uterus. So my next step for me is going to be hysterectomy because I still have, pain and everything like that associated with with adenomyosis.
Is that something you're thinking of doing in like soon or further in the
Yes.
future? Soon.
No,
Wow.
yeah, I have my 2 girls and
Yeah.
I think I'm ready to get my quality of life back. But yeah, it's something that I've lived with for the last 8 years. I have a song on my that's out called The Way I'm Wired, and I wrote it for my endo warriors and
Oh.
also anyone who suffers with any type of chronic illness. It's really for anyone suffering with any chronic illness, any mental, physical illness where you're just really honest in the moment of actually what it feels like to live this way.
That's really beautiful. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes as well so that people can listen to that. For those warriors, is there anything that you would like them to know or to hear from you, like as somebody who's gone through it?
Yeah, a lot of time endo warriors think that they're a burden, that they're difficult, that they're, because they have to cancel plans and they, you can feel like a burden on society, right? Or a burden to your relationships. But I think endo warriors need to remember that they're stronger than they think. They're warriors. There's women out there raising kids, going to work, getting up out of bed and just getting up for the day. When you're in the type of chronic pain and fatigue that I was in, that you are a warrior and a stronger than you know. The fact that you show up and the fact that you know when to rest, that's you being strong. And I think that society has let down women's health. And so, there's a lot of times when you're an endo warrior, like, what did I do? Why can't I handle this? Why can't I do this? Just know that like society let women down. And is a whole community of millions of women who are dealing with the same condition. And we just have to be there for each other and know that you're not a burden. You're not being difficult. This is just the cards you were dealt, and you're doing the best that you can. Like, that's just remember you're doing the best that you can. I always have to tell myself that you're doing the best you can. That's all you can do. And as a high achiever, like a very ambitious, high achieving person, if you're like me, you really have to fight those thoughts,
Yep.
but you're doing the best that you can. That's all any of us are doing every day. And for anyone
You
out there
mean?
who doesn't understand chronic pain and chronic fatigue, who thinks these people are being dramatic, or I always say, like, think about the worst toothache you've ever had. Try go to the gym with that toothache. Try raise your kid, like, try cook the dinner, try go to work. If you're a man, think of your testicle being stapled to your leg, your thigh. Try do everything you do every day, and then come back and tell me that anyone is being dramatic about being in chronic pain or chronic fatigue, because it's very hard to understand. Because I look fine, I've performed, like, and people, you look great, you sound great, and inside I'm being punched repeatedly in the ovary, or stabbed, feels like being stabbed in my back. And I'm like, just because I look fine doesn't mean that I am fine. And that goes for mental health too. So, like, I mean, I could write a book on all this, but like endo stuff,
Please
but
do.
it's my next book. I have one book coming out about songwriting. That'll be my next one. But
Amazing.
yeah, just be lead with compassion for yourself and for
Yeah.
others, and be empathetic. Just have empathy. You just never know what's going on in someone's life.
You absolutely never know. Well, just to finish up, we always do a little spinning of the Rolodex reel for some quick fire
Love
questions, just a
this.
couple of
Yes.
them. So I'm going to
Go.
spin, and if you
Yeah.
tell me when to stop, I will ask you a question.
Stop.
Who's your celebrity crush?
John Mayer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's like the first time I'd
Wait.
ever agreed with.
Chris Martin as well. Love him.
Oh no, I have to disagree, but I will. I'll go with John Mayer.
Just
But
it's
that's okay.
probably,
You're allowed to have your
yeah,
own.
Chris Martin for me.
Okay. We will spin again.
Stop.
What's your favorite quote?
Feel the fear and do it anyway. I have it tattooed on me.
Excellent. I love
Yeah.
that. And then,
Stop.
what's your karaoke song?
Lauryn Hill, do up that thing. I'm secretly a rapper inside. Like, or like a rap song. I'll always do like Still Dre, any Eminem song, Lauryn Hill. Like, I'm like trying to rap.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
We'll
We'll
do
do
one
one
more.
more.
Stop.
What's your favorite way to relax?
I find it hard to relax.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But since having kids, like, it's the simple things in life. It's a bath with like Epsom salts, a candle, and like an album that I love, like Fleetwood Mac Rumours, or, Grace Jeff Buckley. And I'm just in the bath, getting peace, quiet, and trying to shut my crazy mind off. That's my favorite way to relax now, is that, or just like being with my husband, and we are getting a lie in the morning, and just like literally like lying in the bed of my husband and us both sleeping, like, and I mean like as in, do not touch me, like, we like don't talk to me, just sleeping beside each other for like a whole morning with no interruptions from kids and no emails and no texts, and just laying there together.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. I would love that so
Yes.
much, but
Yes.
it's a very much so a rarity when you have little ones,
Yes.
isn't
It is. It
it?
is. It is. So that's like now our new thing. He took me to Barcelona recently, and like literally, I was like, can we sleep? He's like, oh, babe, we're going to sleep. So we literally, like, what's in the morning, slept and just like laid there till like 12, and then we would go out and do the thing. And I was like, my favorite time is when we've just been getting to just rest and sleep.
Sounds phenomenal. Ruthann,
Yeah.
thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I cannot thank you enough. I could ask you 100,000 more questions, but if
Ah.
there is what have you got next for the people if they want to catch you anywhere or follow you or listen to you?
Yes. So I've written a book. It's called It's Not Just a Song, and it's all about how to forge a successful career in music. So if anyone's out there that wants to know the secrets of how to do this and be a songwriter or a singer or anything, producer, definitely get the book. It's out September 25th, but you can pre-order it now. Head to my Instagram at This Is Ruthann. I have an album coming out called The Moment. My new album is coming out October 10th. There's a song coming out every 6 weeks. Very special of the vow, version of The Vow is coming out, about to come out. And I also have a headline show at the Sugar Club. October 15th in the Sugar Club, I'll be headlining. If you want to get tickets, you can get them now. And yeah, my songs are out and they're in Spotify, Apple, if you want to go listen to my new music and come, like, yeah, support Irish artists.
Definitely will be doing it. We'll put everything in the show notes so everybody can find you. But thank you. I'm sure many, many people will have gotten some amazing nuggets of inspiration from you and some wisdom. So thank you for sharing everything with
Oh,
us.
thank you. It's such a great podcast. Keep doing what you're
Oh, thank
doing.
you. Thank you so much. I really
Okay.
appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, guys, every now and then you have a conversation that stays with you long after the mic is off. My chat with Ruth Ann was exactly that. Like, she reminded me that authenticity really is everything. In her words, now anyone can be a star. Authenticity is what really makes a star now. It's embracing who you are and finding your unique parts and going with that. And when she said that, I really felt it, because it's not just about music, that's about life. And then we also delved into the magic of creativity. Like, Ruth Ann talked about how she wrote The Vow in the middle of the night. And she was doubting it and thinking it was really, really cheesy, but it ended up being like her most successful song. And the most beautiful part, she said, is like, I think I manifested my husband. I met him 3 months later after writing the song, and now I am in that unconditional love. Like, isn't that incredible? Like, I really do believe in the power of manifestation, not as like some kind of wooey subject. You know, it's something that is, when you really like put something out there and create something that's authentically you, you attract that back, that energy back. And I think that that's exactly what she did. Like, one of the most powerful parts of our conversation was like her journey with endometriosis. And like I said at the start, like, I've had no experience with that, but like, I couldn't imagine living with that chronic pain and having to carry on like working and going live. Like, literally, she said, like, she got out on stage when she was in agony and then went back to like being in agony again. You know, like, that's something that we shouldn't have to do. You know, nobody should have to do, living with that kind of pain. But her message to anyone who's going through it is that you're not a burden and you are stronger than you know. So, like, so much courage, vulnerability, and truth. And I'm so grateful to Ruth Ann for sharing it with us. If you want to follow her on Instagram, she is at This Is Ruth Ann, and Ann is with an E. You can also check out her latest single, Complete Me, and she plays in the Sugar Club in Dublin on October the 15th this year. So that's it for this week, guys. If you'd like to get in touch with the Imperfectionist podcast, or if you've got feedback or a topic that you'd like us to discuss, make sure you email carla@golau.com. And until next time, don't forget to show up for yourself and embrace your imperfections.